Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Israel's killing of 7 aid workers from the UK, Australia, Poland, and Canada in the US, who were with Chef Jose Andres's World Central Kitchen, making food for the starving Gazans. Joining us to discuss this and Israel's attacks on UNRWA and its apparent strategy of starvation is Sarah Lee Whitson, the Executive Director of Democracy in the Arab World Now, Dawn, who was formerly the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North African Division, where she oversaw 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She has led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. Then we'll assess whether the Israeli strike on Iran's consulate in Damascus, which killed top Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps officials, will provoke a wider war, and speak with Thanasi Kambanis, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and director of the Center for International Research and Policy. Until recently, he worked as a journalist based in Lebanon, and his books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story, and most recently, Shia Power Comes of Age, The Transformation of Islamist Politics in Iraq, 2003 to 2023. Then finally, we'll examine the results of municipal elections in Turkey, which were a rebuke of the Erdogan dictatorship and the kleptocracy of his family and cronies. Joining us to discuss lessons the U.S. could learn from this reversal of authoritarian rule and the restoration of democracy is Ahmet Yella, a professor of Homeland Security Studies at DeSales University in Pennsylvania, who also teaches counterterrorism courses at Georgetown University and is a fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. He formerly served as professor and the chair of the sociology department at Harran University in Turkey and was a counterterrorism police chief in Turkey. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Sarah Lee Whitson, the Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, Dawn, who was formerly the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversaw 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She has led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Whitson.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there's been a lot of international outrage at the killing of 7 aid workers in Gaza by Israel, for which the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said was unfortunate. But the aid workers come from Poland, Australia, the United Kingdom, and one was a joint Canadian and U.S. citizen. So how do you think this is going to pan out in terms of pressure on Israel to stop what your former boss, the head of Human Rights Watch, Ken Frotz, recently wrote in The Guardian, saying that he accused Israel of having a policy of deliberate starvation?
Well, I think what happens in the face of this new latest atrocity is going to depend on whether or not the United States takes any decisive action. I think that in normal circumstances, were such an abuse, the murder of 7 international aid workers who were coordinates were well known to the Israelis, had taken place by any other government, the United States would be pushing for sanctions, if not for direct military intervention, or even a no-fly zone. And so I think that much of the international community would be prepared to sanction Israel for this latest atrocity, compounding what has been deliberate strategy to keep out humanitarian aid. The only question is whether the United States will continue to shield Israel from accountability.
Well, the aid workers were working, feeding the starving Gazans through the celebrity chef Jose Andres's charity World Central Kitchen, and they had so far have served 42 million meals in 175 days of its operation in Gaza, and they had just unloaded 100 tons of humanitarian food that had been brought in to Gaza by sea earlier that day. But now they've suspended operations, so this would have a real effect on the starving Gazans.
Well, yes, it will. And I must say, it's a well understood, well anticipated effect. All along, Israel has been doing everything it can to stymie the delivery of humanitarian aid. It succeeded in getting UNRWA defunded by its two largest donors, the United States and Germany. It has now succeeded in dissuading, I think, perhaps the second largest aid delivery provider or food provider now to suspend its operations. ANIRA, another humanitarian organization that helps provide surgical medical care to children, has announced today that it's suspending its operations. I think that the only message we can take from this is that Israel is deliberately, openly rebuffing and rejecting the order of the International Court of Justice to stop interfering with the delivery of humanitarian aid in fulfillment of its ongoing goal, a goal it made clear back in October, and a goal that Prime Minister Netanyahu has had for many decades, and that is to drive the Palestinian population out of Gaza. They apparently believe it's not going to be that difficult to push 2.3 million people out. And as some have already commented, the construction of this emergency pier is basically an opening to create some kind of pathway for Palestinians to leave by sea, since the Egyptians have said that they will not or don't want to take in Palestinians into the Sinai Desert.
Well, who's going to take in the 2.2 million, or probably less now, because there's about 33,000 have been killed? But who's going to take the Palestinians in?
Well, I mean, I don't think Israel gives much of a damn who takes them in. As we've seen, millions of refugees streaming into Europe, many even making their way to the United States from North Africa, from sub-Saharan Africa. From their perspective, what's another 2 million on top of the tens of millions of people fleeing as refugees? I don't think they care as long as it's not their problem, although they are also aware that the West and Western Europe and the United States have only been too willing to pay the bills for the catastrophe that Israel has imposed on Palestinians. They have done this for many decades by sustaining the occupation and the survival of the occupation, rebuilding the buildings that Israel would routinely destroy, the schools it would destroy. And so I think that they see this as an opportunity now to carry out a long-held plan to depopulate Gaza of Palestinians.
Well, in terms of these aid workers, these seven that were killed, according to the United Nations, since March 20, at least 196 humanitarian aid workers have been killed in the occupied Palestinian territory. That's since October of 2023. So this is obviously not an isolated incident. I think there's been 95 Palestinian journalists killed as well. So Is that a part of the strategy? If you make it too dangerous for journalists and too dangerous for aid workers, then they all leave and you don't get the pictures of the suffering, or you don't get the food in? Is there a strategy there?
Well, it's actually been a strategy that's been in place for many years to isolate Gaza from the international community, to make entry and exit into Gaza near impossible. So that has been a long-standing strategy since basically 2016, when Israel imposed the siege and closure on Gaza, refusing to allow journalists in, refusing to even allow government officials from international governments in, claiming that it's for their own security, making it exceedingly difficult for aid organizations to get in, so that we in the international community would all just forget about Gaza. And it worked. It works miraculously well. And the only thing that's upended the international community's forgetting about the 2 million people in Gaza is the people of Gaza themselves rattling their cages, carrying out occasional rocket attacks with homemade rockets. And then, of course, the most dramatic game changer of all, the October 7 attack and the October 7 atrocities. Unfortunately, obviously, many Palestinians, some Palestinians believe that there's absolutely no other way to get the attention of the international community without creating some kind of dramatic attack, mind you, obviously a horrific attack that targeted civilians. But nevertheless, nothing else has succeeded in getting the international community to focus on the strangulation of Gaza, the 50-plus-year occupation, the deliberate redevelopment of the population that has very accurately been described as a very large open-air prison.
Well, if that was the strategy of Hamas, I mean, I'm not sure they necessarily wanted to get the attention on the Palestinians so much as they got this burning hatred of Israel, and they also the attack itself was so gruesome. It indicates, you know, an incredible amount of brutality on their part. And they're certainly not coming out of this very well, are they? I mean, I imagine at some point or other, the Palestinians in Gaza are not too happy with Hamas for bringing this destruction upon them. Essentially, it seems as if what Israel's trying to do is to just make Gaza uninhabitable. And they're succeeding.
Well, two things. On Hamas and its motivations and intentions and plans, I don't think we really know yet. I don't think the international community really knows yet. The history has not yet been written, and we still have very few of the facts about what Hamas was planning, what they intended to achieve, what their political and strategic and military goals were in carrying out this attack. And I know that some analysts have speculated based on the available information to them that the planned attack was much smaller and narrower in scope, that they never imagined it would result in hundreds of people not associated with Hamas crossing the border, that they didn't anticipate that this rave concert would be happening minutes from the Gaza border. So it's really not clear whether everything that happened is what was planned. And, you know, I guess irrespective of whether Hamas has the worst intentions or the best intentions with respect to the Palestinian people, the unavoidable reality is that the whole world is now talking about Gaza and what's happening to the Palestinian people, not just as a result of this immediate war and the genocidal actions of Israel, but in the larger context of what comes next. And a year ago, or even on October 6 or October 5, that conversation was dead. And in fact, the Jake Sullivans of this world would have us believe that the Palestinian issue was dead and everything was fine and everything was stable. And so not inconsistent with the fact that the Hamas attack was a gruesome, horrific attack on civilians that is condemnable, it was also politically a game changer, a global game changer, the full repercussions of which we have yet to see. And I think it would be very foolish of us to ignore or underestimate the significance of October 7th, not just for Palestinians and Israelis, but the regional dimensions, and now even potentially impacting the U.S. presidential election.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Sarah, back to your former boss, Kenneth Ross, who has a recent article at The Guardian, Israel's attempt to destroy UNRWA is part of a starvation strategy in Gaza. He's arguing that Israel is trying to destroy the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in Gaza and the West Bank. Do you agree that that is a goal on the part of Israel? Because, go ahead.
Israel has had its sights set on the destruction of UNRWA for many, many years. I think the opportunity of linking them and alleging to link employees of UNRWA to Hamas and the grotesque attack gave them a great opening. And I just want to emphasize that a number of governments have now stated that the reason they are continuing to fund UNRWA is because Israel has not provided any plausible or convincing evidence of the allegations that it made against UNRWA, just as it never, of course, provided any evidence against the six Palestinian NGOs that it labeled as terrorists. But, you know, Human Rights Watch, even before Ken Roth's most recent piece, has documented meticulously, as have a number of humanitarian organizations, how Israel is deliberately using starvation as a weapon of war, a deliberate campaign to starve the Palestinian people. And by driving out UNRWA and ending its operations or trying to end its operations in Gaza, it's not only starving the Palestinian people of food, it's starving their children of education, given the number of schools that UNRWA operates.
So is there a way out of this agony? Obviously, global condemnation must at some point weigh in. I don't imagine that Netanyahu is particularly troubled by it, but presumably there are other people in Israel who don't want their reputation further diminished.
I think there is a way out of this man-made problem, and those are man-made solutions. The first thing, the most important thing that has to happen in order for Israelis and Palestinians to live in peace with their human rights respected is for an end to the military occupation and apartheid rule of Palestinians. After that, it really is about allowing the people who live under Israeli sovereignty to democratically decide what kind of a government they want to establish, what kind of governance they want to have, whether it's one state or two states or three states, whatever. In any country of the world, we try to resolve, we aim to resolve these things democratically. That is the only legitimate way to determine what kind of a system of governance people should have, what their state should look like. But before we can do that, before we can resolve that political problem of governance, we have to first end the emergency of abuses, the emergency to life created by Israel's war, by its ongoing military occupation and land theft, and by its apartheid rule.
Well, Sarah Whitson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I may speak with Sarah Whitson, who's the Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, Dawn, who was formerly the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversaw 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She has led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an assessment whether the Israeli strike on Iran's consulate in Damascus, which killed top Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps officials, will provoke a wider war. يا ما شو عمل فينا Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Thanasi Kambanis, who's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and director of the Center for International Research and Policy. Until recently, he worked as a journalist based in Lebanon, and his books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story, and most recently, Shia Power Comes of Age, The Transformation of Islamist Politics in Iraq, 2003 to 2023. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Always interesting to talk with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Thanasi. And what do you make of the Israeli attack on Monday on the Iran's consulate in Damascus, that's right next door to the embassy? It is a diplomatic post, so that's a violation of international law. Not that the Iranians didn't violate international law by taking the American embassy back in the days of Ayatollah Khamenei back in 1979. But still, it's a pretty major escalation. Do you think it's going to have broader ramifications in the region?
Well, this is what we're trying to figure out as analysts. So first of all, to your I think your implicit question is, how big of a deal is this? How significant is this strike? It certainly looks like a not just like a big escalation, but like a major symbolic strike in the back and forth between Israel and Iran. What's new or significant about it? So one is that it's a strike, as you said, on a diplomatic compound. It's also the kind of very symbolic targeted assassination abroad that attracts a lot more attention than the sort of usual and almost routine at this stage bombing of weapons depots and supply centers where rockets and other weapons are being transited from Iran to factions that are fighting against Israel. So this, of course, raises a lot of alarms. We saw a very strong reaction from Iran, which vowed a retaliation. We saw a lot of outrage. When I take a step back, I have a couple of sort of starting initial takeaways. So one is, how significant is this? Well, it's I actually think it's less significant than meets the eye. The Israelis and the Americans, by the way, have been routinely bombing axis of resistance targets in Syria and Iraq for years, but in an accelerated way since October 7th. And this particular senior military leader who was killed from the Revolutionary Guard Corps, you know, of course, this is a significant operational hit for the Iranian military. But this is not like the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, who was the supreme commander of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and who was hands-on coordinating all kinds of Iranian military activity around the region. This is much more minor, and it's war. It's war. These are institutions that are designed to rebound from the loss of personnel. So it's like the killing of a mid-level or sort of low-ranking senior commander. It's not going to disrupt Iran's capability to do the disruptive things it's doing in the region. It's not going to stop the transfer of rockets or weapons from Iran to its axis of resistance proxies in Syria and elsewhere. It's not going to hurt the relationship between Hamas and Iran, to the extent that that's important for Hamas's ability to make war. So what we're left with is the question of, does this lead to an escalation in the regional war? Does this reopen the risk of a direct confrontation between the U.S. and Iran? Does it provoke a major escalation by Iran in order to retaliate? And this is, I want to be careful about making predictions that will be could be proven untrue at time. But my strong feeling is that, in fact, this will not spark a major escalation. We're actually in a moment where Iran, Israel, and the U.S. in their sort of military engagement with each other have been moving towards a little bit of restraint. And I think what we'll hear is some very angry rhetoric from Iran, and then we'll see Iran continue its business as usual of sending weapons to its proxies and allies, I don't think we're going to see some big showy retaliation that risks a sparking a new round of direct conflagration in the region.
But Thanasi, the two generals that were killed in the strike on Monday at the consulate next to the Iranian embassy in Damascus were General Sahidi and General Rahimi. They were both with the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and the Quds Force. Sahidi was the commander of the Quds Force in Syria, Quds meaning, of course, Jerusalem. So they weren't minor players.
Of course not. But, you know, I brought up Soleimani to remind people that, you know, in this, you know, in these long running conflicts, killing individual personnel doesn't in any way shift the strategic field, right? So there have been tit for tat assassinations for years, and I think, you know, specifically in two cases, right, the long running campaign against Al Qaeda ISIS, in which hundreds of senior leaders, including the top leaders, have been assassinated over and over every couple of months, and it in no way changes the trajectory of that group. And in the case of the shadow war between Israel and Iran, again, for decades, Israel has been assassinating senior commanders. The U.S. has joined in from time to time. It has in no way affected Iran's ability to project power. It's a non-issue for Iran's ability to, whether it's sending weapons or giving political cover or sending well-trained soldiers into battle or coordinating infantry for these different resistance factions and for the Syrian government. You know, this has been an uninterrupted state policy, and, you know, without minimizing the consequence of these assassinations, like, I mean, I think it's bad policy. I think policy by assassination is unsound policy for the U.S. and for Israel. However, I also want to say it doesn't have its intended effect. If the intended effect is to interrupt or change the capability of the state actor on the other side of the calculus, which is Iran and the IRGC, it doesn't affect it. I mean, that's not my opinion. That's what time has shown over several decades of this approach being deployed against Iran. So that's all I'll say. I'm sure if you are inside Iranian operations in Syria today, there is some disruption as there, you know, these two people who were in charge of whatever portfolios they were operationally in charge of are being replaced. But it's the military, for Christ's sakes. I mean, this is how the chain of command is designed to seamlessly continue when people get killed. And it's no different when we're talking about these sort of office jobs that the RGC has around the region than it is when we're talking about regular battlefield operations.
Well, I assume, though, that the IRGC and the Quds are pretty angry. And, you know, Ayatollah Khamenei's son, the heir apparent, he's also a senior member of the IRGC. So I don't know whether they're putting pressure on Khamenei. He did make a public statement saying the evil regime will be punished by the hands of our brave men. We will make them regret this crime and others like it. The flagrant violation of the United Nations Charter, international law, and the foundational principle of the inviolability of diplomatic and consular premises. Again, that's pretty rich coming from the revolutionary Iranian Islamic Republic founders like Ayatollah Khomeini, who took the American embassy hostages for 444 days back in 1979. That clearly was breaking the very diplomatic inviolability that Ayatollah Khomeini is now complaining about.
I mean, let's put this in the context of what another parallel a confrontation that played out over the last month with an Iranian proxy is. So in Iraq, we had this acceleration of attacks on U.S. targets. The lead player there was Kataib Hezbollah, which is the Iraqi faction most closely tied to the IRGC. So of all the Iraqi armed groups. This is the one that is most cleanly and clearly understood to be a pure proxy rather than ally with some autonomy. It's a proxy of Iran. It was leading these attacks. And the U.S. was exhibiting some amount of restraint and reacting piecemeal. Eventually, the U.S. unleashed this barrage of attacks, which included bombing Qatar Hezbollah facilities in downtown Baghdad. A few civilians, or it seems like a few civilians, were killed in those strikes. Those strikes outraged the Iraqi government, outraged Iran, outraged the resistance factions. Some people even here suggested that maybe that was overreached by the U.S. But in fact, what was the result? The result was that Qatar Hezbollah then stood down, unilaterally stopped attacking U.S. targets. The Iraqi prime minister was subsequently able to plan a state visit to Washington, D.C., which is on the calendar for April 15th in a couple of weeks. And it's been relatively quiet on the Iraqi front after this, this large lashing out by the U.S., which was followed, by the way, with, a fair amount of outrage commentary from Iran as well. Now, OK, this is the case I'm telling you about in Iraq was less consequential, less delicate than the case we're talking about today in Syria. But I see a lot of parallels, and I see that the Iranians are fundamentally realists in their calculus, right? They're doing the things they're doing in order to maximize their leverage and power and influence around the region. And they know that in head-to-head conventional warfare matchups with their rivals, the U.S., Israel, other local rivals, they're not going to come out that well. So where they're at their most advantage in asymmetrical guerrilla-style warfare. So I think in reality, their retaliation is going to be to continue to arm and support these proxy and hybrid forces around the region. So the IRGC and its actual councils of war is going to look at how it can exercise the most power it can realistically get. And it understands that it simply can't go head to head in a, it can't match the Israelis bombing for bombing, assassination for assassination. It hasn't ever been able to. That's not their arena. That's not where they're able to exercise the influence that they've been able to exercise. And it's, it's a spoilers game, ultimately, that they're playing. And it has, to some extent, worked for them. Although I would think in the internal discussions that the Iranians have, where, you were sort of suggesting there might be constituencies in the IRGC who are arguing for some kind of fierce pushback to show outrage for their attacked brethren. There might also be factions of the IRGC and of the Supreme Leader's inner circle who see Iranian power being eroded by overreach. I mean, that I'm not sure we're at the point yet where they're going to recognize what they're doing as overreach, but certainly from the outside, even if you look at it from their own vantage point, from their own spoilers game criteria, they are engaging in a form of overreach, which costs them assets that they worked decades to build, right? They build up these proxy forces and then they squander them by trying to have far more power than they could ever actually have.
Well, there's no question the Iranian people hate this regime, and one of their main complaints is that they spend all their money on Hezbollah and going after Israel and not on bread and butter issues at home. But just in the last couple of minutes, though, Thanasi, their main proxy, of course, in the neighborhood is Hezbollah, which could rain rockets down on Israel. And given the nature of Netanyahu, how he's isolated, he's fighting this war, he's pulling, taking the gloves off as much as he can, and it's getting more and more horrible. But he's in there for the long haul. He wants this war to go on forever, because the minute it's over, he might well go to jail. So he has an incentive, doesn't he? Do you think he's going to, is this strike on the consulate in Syria, in Damascus, any, is that a way to needle the Hezbollah into, you know, escalating on that front? Because
I mean, you're speaking to my deepest worry about the next horrific thing that's going to happen in the region as an outgrowth of Israel's current war. I'm increasingly convinced and fearful that Israel really does intend to start a full-on war with Lebanon. That Israel sees its opportunity now. Mobilized as it is in Gaza, and by the way, in the West Bank, where it's on quite a terror as well, while most of the world's attention is focused on Gaza, that it wants to, quote unquote, take care of Lebanese Hezbollah while it's on this war footing. And I do think that's unfortunately in the cards, and that's an Israeli plan. And I also would say one other thing. I don't think it's a Netanyahu problem. I think it's an Israel problem. I think if Netanyahu disappeared tomorrow from the government, wasn't in power, I think we would still have the same really terrible. So, like, you can't solve the problem while Netanyahu's in power, but without Netanyahu in power, you still have the same problem, which is that the majority of the Israeli security establishment and of Israeli public opinion supports the way the war is being executed in Gaza, and supports the maximalist war crime rich policy that Israel has adopted. So I'm very worried that that's the next stage. I don't think, to be honest, that the strike in Damascus has much bearing one way or another on this. I mean, I had this worry before the strike. I have this worry now. I think when that war starts, it's not going to be because Lebanese Hezbollah gets provoked into some kind of overreaction. I think it's going to be because Israel goes ahead and starts a full-on assault in Lebanon. And that's how that chapter will unfold, will begin. And the human suffering is going to be horrible. And it's going to be just as, it's not going to be possible for Israel to deracinate Hezbollah any more than it's been possible for them to deracinate Hamas. So that's an unfortunate next chapter that I think we can expect to see, before the U.S. election in the fall.
Well, Thanasi Kambalos, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Take care, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Thanasi Kambalos, who's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and director of the Center for International Research and Policy. Until recently, he worked as a journalist based in Lebanon, and his books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story, and most recently, Shia Power Comes of Age, The Transformation of Islamist Politics in Iraq, 2003 to 2023. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the results of municipal elections in Turkey, which were a rebuke of the Erdogan dictatorship and the kleptocracy of his family and cronies. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ahmet Yela, who is a professor of homeland security at DeSales University in Pennsylvania. He also teaches counterterrorism courses at Georgetown University and is a fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. He formerly served as a professor and the chair of the sociology department at Harran University in Turkey and was a counterterrorism police chief in Turkey. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ahmet Yela.
Thank you for the invitation. Very happy to be here with you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ahmet. And what do you make of the rebuke to Turkey's authoritarian leader, Erdogan, in the elections that just took place in Turkey in the main cities, mayoral elections? And of course, Istanbul, that's where a fifth of the entire population of Turkey resides. And that used to be, of course, Erdogan grew up in Istanbul and was previously the mayor of Istanbul. So the fact
Correct.
That his party lost by 11 percentage points by a million votes is pretty shocking. And I'm sure he's pretty rattled by it. How does it strike you?
So I think this was somewhat expected for a variety of reasons, and I would like to focus on this. But of course, Erdogan is really upset. Maybe this is the beginning of the end for Erdogan. However, we need to understand his term is until 2028. So there is a good chance that he is going to stay in power. And also, he has been grooming his son, Bilal Erdogan, to replace him. So all those are questionable, and we don't know what will happen in the near future, but it is for sure that he lost the majority support in Turkey. And when I look at different variables that affected these results, I came up with three or four important elements that contributed to his huge loss. If you don't mind, I would like to go through them so that we can better understand what happened behind the scenes. But at the same time, if you remember, there was a presidential election. And we all said that AKP, Erdogan's political party, won that election and Erdogan became president one more time. However, today what we understand, Erdogan did not win, but CHP, the opposing party, who was running with Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, lost the elections. So we can understand that it was a very poor campaign on their behalf. Later on, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu resigned and replaced by Özgür Özel. So CHP, the main opposition party who won the majority of the cities for the municipality elections, was led or has been led by a new and younger blood. His name is Özgür Özel. So why did Erdogan lose this election, even though he had a huge and strong grasp on the Turkish society by controlling almost the majority of media and controlling the social media as well? The first element is people are hungry. They are really hungry. The economic situation in Turkey is really, really bad. The inflation, official inflation is 65%, but the real inflation people feel at the market is over 100%. So in a year, almost all the prices of the goods doubled, whereas the salaries and the capacity of people generating income have not. In fact, around officially 10% of the Turks are jobless. They do not have any work to do. And there are a lot of social media posts, people explaining how they cannot survive in these circumstances. A family of four, mother and father working full-time, cannot even, in many cases, pay for a rent. So people felt the hunger at this level in Turkey for a long time, first time in 2023 and 2024. That contributed extensively, basically running away from Erdogan. And people looked at the reasons why this was happening. And the answer is corruption. And this has two faults. Erdogan is deeply corrupted, and everybody understands and knows it. And there is a term in Turkey among the Erdogan supporters. They say, yes, Erdogan is corrupted, but every political party is corrupted. So I'm going for my political party, and they're going to be corrupted anyway. But this time was different because the level of corruption and basically, the money they were stealing was huge. That collapsed the Turkish economy. And if you understand the importance of the municipalities, we can better make sense of this corruption. The majority of the corruption happens through the municipality tenders, like the construction or service jobs that are being awarded to different municipalities. And the logic of AKP, Erdogan's political party's approach to those tenders is, those contracts are given to the cronies of Erdogan regime who are basically working with the Erdogan and his people and paying at least 20 to 50% of the amount of the money they are receiving as a back payment to either Erdogan's representatives or directly to Erdogan's front organizations, associations, or companies. And there are a lot of official tax amnesties to Erdogan's close friends who were given the most expensive contracts at the amount of billions of dollars. And these were all made public most of the times through social media, not through the print or TV media, because Erdogan mostly controls them. And people started to realize the heat over this corruption scheme Erdogan ran for over 20 years. And Erdogan is so upset because he's not going to be able to continue as he lost the municipality control through the mayors around the country. There were posts 2 days ago where AKP municipalities were burning for former tender paperwork so that their corruption for those contracts could not be found with the new administration, with the new mayors. Now, there is an argument that CHP is a central leftist leftist party, and the Turkish people are basically running away from central conservative party, basically represented by Erdogan, towards the left. But I am not 100% sure about that. I think what's happening here is the people who voted for Erdogan and his political party are now opting for, in their minds, the lesser evil. And how do I read this? There are a few things that had been going on. The corruption has been extensively presented to the public, and Erdogan was not mum about it, and he oftentimes did not even lie those claims, deny those claims. Parts of the voting base for Erdogan accepted it openly and said, this is his right. He is running for us. He is managing, directing this country as the president of Turkey for us. Therefore, he deserves it. But the majority of people were fed up with it, particularly when the excessive amount of hunger started to exist for the last 2 years. And then the association of that corruption with the religion of Islam, because Erdogan always came out as a pious Islamic leader, not only in Turkey, but around the world, particularly among the Islamic countries as well. And honestly, the corruption is one of the biggest sins in the religion of Islam. So not being able to associate this behavior with the religion people believe in was one of the most critical disconnects between Erdogan and his base. The second is the lies Erdogan and his media constantly pumped. And that didn't work either, and that backfired. People eventually learned the truth, and they understood that they were being lied. The third is happening, I think, with the Palestine and Israel conflict. Erdogan, even though he constantly goes after Netanyahu and Israel in front of the public, Turkey had been one of the highest providers of supplies to Israel and the IDF. The Turkish statistics that are available online, which are produced by the government agencies, indicated that Turkey had been sending arms, steel, oil, and other supplies to Israel. Erdogan denied it. However, people started to share the screenshots of the statistics between Turkey and Israel, the trade between Turkey and Israel, and how Turkey was directly and indirectly supporting the IDF. And then there was a huge outcry about the actions of the Erdogan government when it comes to sending particularly arms to Israel that were claimed to be killing the Palestinians. I think that also affected the base very deeply, that hypocrisy coming out of Erdogan and lying about it turned them away. The last one that I was able to come up is the prominent AKP people who are the cronies of Erdogan and who are deeply corrupted were never shy of sharing their extravagant lifestyles. The cars that they were driving, Mercedes, Bentley, Jaguars, Porsche, that you cannot under normal circumstances afford in Turkey very easily. The drugs they were using, the alcohol, and as they kept sharing those images and videos on social media, people started to reshare them and address the hypocrisy among the high-level prominent AKP leaders who were working with Erdogan. And that also turned away a huge chunk of population from Erdogan. So I think at the end, I came up with these elements that affected the loss of the mayoral and municipality elections for the Erdogan's government. And we also need to understand Erdogan did his best with his ministers and with the state powers to win this election. But CHP was well organized and they did not allow corruption at the voting locations. So they were not able to steal as many votes as they planned, looks like, in the
Well,
end.
the mayor of Istanbul, who won clearly, İmamoğlu said in his victory speech, "Starting from tomorrow, Turkey will be a different Turkey. You opened the door to the rise of democracy, equality, and freedom. You ignited hope at the ballot box. People oppressed under authoritarian regimes must now turn their gaze to Istanbul." So the question for me, Ahmet, is how does this reflect on America? In other words, if the Turks are finally getting rid of an authoritarian leader or undermining his power, we have an authoritarian leader in waiting in Donald Trump, who in many ways is similar. He has a family business, the cronies, they're all kleptocrats. We have a similar situation in this country, the divide between the rural and the urban, and the urban people support Biden, the rural people don't. And in Erdogan's case, his base is still in the country. He's lost all the cities. There are certain comparisons. Obviously, Trump hasn't been in power for 20 years like Erdogan has. So, is there a lesson here for us in America who are concerned about the possibility of having a leader like Erdogan in November?
I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned. By the way, I would like to express this. Donald Trump openly said that Erdogan was his best friend and they both love each other. And I still couldn't find out or figure out where the connection comes from. I think both leaders loved dividing the country and ruling over that division. And when we look at terrorism studies, radicalization requires people being divided and into camps and believing that the other camp is their enemy and therefore they ne never should trust them and they should never believe in them. And that enemy is out there to get them. Erdogan successfully implemented this by using the religion of Islam. He represented himself as the leader of Islam in Turkey and the other political parties as the enemies of Islam. Trump also succeeded a similar division in the United States. Regular media outlets cannot reach to that base to pass the facts because facts mean nothing at this point. As long as this misinformation and hypocritical campaign continues, I think it is very difficult to wake these people up. There must be like a mobilization to reach out to those people and convince them about what they are hearing, not being factual, only propaganda and lies. And it is a very difficult job because when people are divided, they do not trust each other. And it takes sometimes generational efforts to convince them otherwise.
Well, there's another comparison too between Trump and Erdogan. Erdogan is losing because he's an economic ignoramus. He has the stupidest ideas about the economy, and that's caused 65% inflation and 50% interest rates. And Trump, of course, has this idea of putting tariffs on Chinese and Mexican goods and imported goods. He believes that that costs the Chinese and the Mexicans pay the price, but it's actually the American consumer that pays the price. And everything, and suddenly, if Trump takes over, everything's going to get more expensive. So they do have that in common as well, just in closing.
Yes.
Yeah. So any final thoughts then of what we can take away from this reversal of an autocratic rule in Turkey and the glimmerings of hope with this new leader that democracy can return?
I think I can say there is hope, but I am not as optimistic as İmamoğlu, because Erdoğan still is the president until 2028, and he, I'm sure, is planning to run again or to put someone to represent him in that seat. He also controls the military, but more importantly, MIT, Turkish National Intelligence, and the justice system. The justice system is so deeply corrupted in Turkey that nobody trusts. Even Erdoğan's own people do not trust the justice system. And the judges are ordered to basically carry out their decisions through the MIT personnel that are assigned to the court system. So I am not seeing a sudden change in Turkey at this point. Yes, Erdoğan lost a lot of blood. Yes, he is not going to corrupt the municipalities as he used to. Yes, some people are more going to be aware of what was going on behind the scenes, but I think it will take some time. I hope that people can share the irregularities on the social media more than ever, because the majority of the news outlets in Turkey are controlled by him, so that people can wake up. I think for the United States, the lesson is fighting against extremism and hypocrisy and corruption.
Well, Ahmet Yela, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You are very welcome. Thank you for the invitation. Very nice talking to you.
Likewise, and again, I've been speaking with Ahmet Yela, who is a professor of Homeland Security at DeSales University in Pennsylvania. He also teaches counterterrorism courses at Georgetown University and is a fellow in the program of extremism at George Washington University. He formerly served as a professor and the chair of the sociology department at Harran University in Turkey and was a counterterrorism police chief in Turkey. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared.